Please give a very warm welcome to Maude Barrow.
Well, thank you, Leo, very, very much. And thank all of you so much for being here tonight and for coming out in such numbers. When we claim that we care and that there is an alternative voice out there, it's really important that it's true. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the enthusiastic welcome, and just being here together just gives me enormous energy. People often say to me, where do you get all your, you know, your energy when you kind of get depressed about some of the things you talk about? And I say, well, I come out and give speeches to you and get you upset, and then I feel better. Which is not really untrue. That's actually kind of true. And I have to tell you, coming to St. John is coming home. My mother was raised here in Moncton. My dad was raised in Pointe du Chien. I was born in Digby, Nova Scotia. My dad was the first town social worker. I spent all my summers in this area, so this really is coming home to me. I still feel away is away, and I'm still, my heart is still here. So I feel very close to Atlantic Canada, particularly New Brunswick. And when I come back here, I know in my heart and my roots of my family who has been here for generations. Well, my dad's family was the potato famine, so it really is generations. What the struggles have been here. When I look at this Atlantica, I see the struggles personified. But instead of this being done to New Brunswick and the Maritimes by Ottawa, it's done by some of our very own right here in our own community. So I just want to start off thinking, remembering that my father's father was a fisherman in Pointe du Chien, and I come from a really deep and very humble and important, I think humbly important roots of this community. This is a very important initiative, what we're doing here tonight. It's absolutely key that voices other than the elite voices of the big business community and their political friends are heard for over this far-reaching and ambitious and, in my opinion, very dangerous project. But I want to talk for a few minutes about what's happening at the national level, because you need to know that Atlantica is one of a number of regional conferences like this, on projects like this, planned as part of a much bigger thing. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about that bigger thing. It's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. You probably haven't read very much about it. Should have gone to Parliament, did not. What happened is that after 9/11, the big business community in this country, specifically and particularly the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, the same gang that brought us free trade, they used to be called the Business Council on National Issues. That's Tom DiPino, same group. 150 biggest corporations, many of them American branch plants operating here, decided that things were going to have to change. They realized that for the U.S., security now trumped trade. And if they wanted to keep that border open and keep what they believed were the fruits of NAFTA for them, they were going to have to offer up to the U.S. something very specific. And so they went back and started working with the right-wing think tanks in this country and working with the politicians, and came up with a very strong and broad set of recommendations for what some of us are calling Fortress North America, a kind of European Union, but without any of the safeguards, environmental or social or equitable human rights kind of conditions that were originally built into the European Union. But they are talking about a very ambitious bloc, a North American bloc that would have a kind of, as one premier called it, a security ziploc around it. And it would be a bloc that would use Canada's resources, the United States power, military and corporate power, and of course the cheap migrant labor of Mexico to become a bloc that will compete with China and of course will assert America's dominance in militarily around the world. And of course you should know, if this is something that does not, in my opinion, get the publicity it deserves, that the United States under George Bush is going into space. They are weaponizing space. As that Lance Lord, the head of the defense ministry, says, he says that space weaponization may not be their birthright, but it is their destiny. And they are going there. They have space military superiority, they want to keep it, and they're going to keep it. So we're talking here about merging into the bloc with an administration that is taking the world into military, potential military warfare from space. So this Canadian Council of Chief Executives called for a North American passport. North American point of entry, so that if somebody comes to visit you from somewhere and has no intention of going to the United States, they still have to prove to the U.S. authorities they're allowed into the block. Okay, and they're also talking about merged immigration and visa refugee policy, which is already taking place. They're talking about a security perimeter and mirroring in all three countries the security provisions of Homeland Security, and that is happening in this country and has already happened in many ways. They're talking about common defense, and I don't know if any of you saw the posters that were all around Washington a month ago showing Canadians in Afghanistan with their boots on supporting Iraq. Gee, I thought we all thought we were there as peacekeepers. It turns out maybe Mr. Harper's just a little bit more honest than Mr. Martin, but that we really are there just to support the Americans in Iraq. They're talking about an energy pact and a full resource pact, and some of them are openly talking about that, including water, by the way. They're talking about fully harmonized standards and regulations across the board, whether it's food, seeds, health and safety, environment. We have to not only go through what's called the smart regulation process, which means deregulation in every sector of our economy and our environment and our health and safety and food systems, but then we have set up cross-border committees and workforces and task forces to integrate our deregulated system with the U.S. system, so that if we change our minds and we get governments who feel that that's not been a good thing, to bring in what they call risk assessment instead of the precautionary principle, so that, of course, you'd have to count how many people you think might get ill or die before you take a product off the market, as opposed to saying you need to know it has to be safer. So these are the kind of changes that have happened in the U.S. that we're now entering into in Canada. If you want to change that, in the future you're going to have to somehow undo those agreements that we've made with this country to the south of us. So this is already happening in a very important and profound way at the national level. And I would be worried about this in any case because it's had no public scrutiny, no public debate. It has not gone to Parliament. It is far more far-reaching than NAFTA or anything we have done previous to NAFTA, but there has been no public debate. There have been no other groups, whether environmental or human rights or education or health or people concerned with children and social policy or any other aspect of Canadian life that's been involved. This has been between the big business community and the senior political level in Ottawa that this has taken place. So I would be worried enough about that, but I am deeply and doubly, triply worried that we have entered into this kind of Fortress North America arrangement with George Bush's administration, which I would argue is the most right-wing, anti-environmental, anti-human rights, anti-social rights, socially conservative, pro-military government in history. And this is a very, very serious problem for us, and it should be the top debate that we're having in this country. Now, the Martin Liberals totally bought into this. In Waco, Texas, in March of 2005, Vincente Fox and George Bush and Paul Martin signed something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. You need to know more about this, because that's what Atlantica is based on. And they agreed and came back and implemented this so-called smart regulation process, where we have now agreed to harmonize across the board, whether it's environment or health and safety or the military or security. We are harmonizing our process in a very systemic way. But it intensified under Stephen Harper, who was clearly philosophically and politically very closely aligned to George Bush and feels very comfortable with the direction in which that country is going. So this past March, just 2 months ago, in Cancun, Mexico, thank you, they deepened their commitment, and this time they brought Tom DeQuino from our country, the head of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, four other senior CEOs, and each other country brought five people, and these 15 senior business leaders of the continent set up a competitiveness Council of North America. And they are now going to co-govern with the governments of the three countries this whole new project called Fortress North America. And again, not one other sector was invited or participated in this negotiation. So as I say, it's gone way beyond NAFTA and yet has not gone to Parliament. And the communication strategy, very clear, this is not subtle, coming out was stated by the Harper government and the three governments coming out of the Cancun summit a few months ago was the following. They're going to have continued meetings with the business community. They're going to have round tables with other stakeholders, and they're going to have briefings with parliamentarians. Now, what this says to me is that this is the new form of governance in Canada. This is governance by elite. This is governance by those who have not been elected but have become so powerful that they dictate policy, and in such a way that we're not even taking it to parliaments or our provincial legislatures anymore to debate. So the whole project is the brainchild of the big business community, and as I say, no other voices have been included. This is the mirror of what's happening here in Atlantic Canada with Atlantica. This is starting with the big business community. No, at this moment, there are no senior politicians from the two countries or any of the provinces or states slated to be there, but that's how it happened at the national level. It was decided within the big business community first, and then it moved on and was handed as a kind of blueprint to the politicians who bought it hook, line, and sinker, and then was sold to the Canadian people as just one more kind of small agreement and nothing too significant. Atlantic Canada is this region's part of this cross-border project, and there are going to be several others of these across the country, driven by the Privy Council, which has been tasked with bringing this deep harmonization, this deep integration to subnational governments across the country. And it, of course, like at the national level, has excluded all other voices but the voices of its own. And of course, the amount of money that's being asked to go to that conference in itself, even if people were welcome, keeps most of us out in any case. And what do we know about Atlantica? Well, all of us will speak to that, and I know people in this room will speak to it very passionately as well, but I just want to say the following things and then stop so my colleagues can speak. The first thing that reaching Atlantica is not an inclusive conference. This is governance by elite, and this is a very, very bad sign. It needs to be challenged at the fundamental area of democracy. This is an anti-democratic process in every way. Reaching Atlantica is driven by corporate interests. The conference sponsors include giant corporations. You probably know them. This is the way of the world now. Every time I go to a conference, it's supposed to be about governments, or governance is brought to you by corporations. I just got back from Mexico City for the Fourth World Water Forum, supposedly put on by governments, totally sponsored by the big water companies like Suez and the big bottled water companies like Coca-Cola. Memories of being at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in South Africa a few years ago, where all the governments of the world came together 10 years after Rio to see how we were doing. And the first thing I saw when I got off the plane was a great big De Beers ad on a huge billboard. But instead of a diamond that said diamonds are forever, it was a teardrop or a raindrop that said water is forever, brought to you by De Beers. And at this conference, the big water companies actually sat as voting delegates with the governments, the government delegations. And again, not one other sector had this power. Reaching Atlantica threatens the ability of governments to effectively represent their citizens, because this is being done outside of the democratic process, and it is extremely important that we challenge the way that this is happening. Its identified goal is attached attending the yearly New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers Conference. So already they have identified that after they get their act together and they have come up with their projects and recommendations, they are going to start influencing government, not coming to the people, not taking this message to the rest of us. Reaching Atlantica promotes economic integration with the United States, and again, I don't think there's anyone in this room or anyone in New England that doesn't want closer ties, cultural ties, environmental ties, ties of people to people, teaching each other how to live in this wonderful part of the world sustainably in relation to nature, respectfully with one another. That's not the model that they have here. They're talking about integration with George Bush's America. And we all know what happens when $1 trillion, and that's what they'll spend this year, $1 trillion US, between their military and their war on terror, we know what happens to infrastructure and ordinary people and social programs when that kind of money is spent there. We saw it in New Orleans when people were left behind just to fend for themselves when nature assaulted New Orleans. In my research for my book on deep integration, I found that in the last, since 2000, when George Bush first came to power, they've cut welfare by 13% every year. And can you imagine what it's like living anywhere in the bottom half of America? In fact, under George Bush, the United States has just surpassed every other part of the world in having the greatest income inequality and class inequality in the world. It's even deeper and more pronounced than it is in Latin America. This is the America of a small elite, and this is governance by elite, and this is the model for Atlantica. Reaching Atlantica promotes political integration with the United States, political integration along the lines of this race to the bottom, the lowest common denominator. What's good for big business somehow will be good for the rest of us. Well, you've heard that before, and you know it's not true. We're not going to buy it this time. Reaching Atlantica threatens the rights of workers. We know that, and other people are going to speak to it, but it is terribly important that we name that this is an assault on working people and on their unionized rights. They cannot have the world they want in which everybody's a winner. They have to create a world of winners and losers, and that this is a clear and not very subtle attempt to identify who those losers are going to be under the language of all of us being winners. And Atlantica, reaching Atlantica, it will be terrible for the environment. They're talking about this massive superhighway coming through this region. Let me tell you, it'll be a superhighway to further take away the resources and the brightest young people in our region. And if you want to see what a super NAFTA highway looks like, go stay in a motel on the strip in Windsor, Ontario, as the Windsor Detroit strip, as the cars go by, 16 at a time. The cars and trucks go by 16 at a time, 24/7. It is a recipe for environmental disaster. It is not about building sustainable communities. It's not about the people in Atlantica. It is about taking what's best from Atlantica. And frankly, it's a kind of theft of the brilliance, the creativity, the diversity that is this community and is this community's future. I started talking about my parents, and I just want to end by telling you that my own dad, who died a few years ago of Parkinson, my dad was in the war and was actually hit in the head by a bullet that never exited. My mom used to say that explained a lot. But actually how they met was very sweet. My mom was married to a boy who grew up near her. She didn't know my dad very well as a kid. And that young man went off to war when they were just 6 weeks married. They were 20 and 21. And he said to her at the airport, "I won't be back. So have a wonderful life. I won't be back," because all those first boys were killed. And he, in fact, was. What my mom, they didn't know when she saw him off at the airport was that she was pregnant with my older sister. So when she discovered that, she moved back into her parents' community. This was a small community outside of Moncton, and spent the war there. And then when my dad came home, was hit in the head with his bullet, and then the war ended, that's how they met. And one day he was coming up my mother's steps. My grandmother, who was terribly Scottish, had a very deep Scottish brogue, said, "Well, now here comes Billy McGrath." And my mom said, "Now you sent him next door. He's got a date with Mary. He's had a date with the girl next door. But I guess he looked gorgeous in his uniform and so on." So my grandmother said, now you behave yourself, Flossie. She said, "Billy McGrath's coming up these steps. He's coming in the house. You're going to marry him." She said, "If you can't do it, get in the kitchen. I'll look after him." So that's a true story. My mother went back in the kitchen, and my sister, who was just about to turn four, remembers seeing our dad for the first time, peeking out behind my mother's skirts. And my dad knocked on the door, and he said, "Do I have the right address?" My grandmother said, "You sure do, Billy McGrath. Get in here." And they were married 3 months later because nobody said no to my grandma, right? But I tell you this because my dad and mom were part of that phenomenal generation that decided that they were going to stand for something, that they had given up so much. My dad was wounded. I've read recently that Parkinson's, for many people who die of Parkinson's or have Parkinson's, there was a head trauma. And so I think of my dad as being a kind of World War II casualty a number of years later. But my mom lost her husband, and my sister lost her father. My dad lost his very best friend sitting behind him beside him in a trench. And I mean, that whole generation saw such terrible things. And when they came back, my dad said they decided that they had to make something of their lives, that they would build what he called a social nation state, in which the economy and trade and business serves people and communities. And that same government that couldn't feed, house, clothe, or employ anybody before the war and suddenly had enough money to do all of that during the war would not be allowed to say, well, suddenly we have other interests and we have other priorities and we can't do that anymore. And they said about building those ribbons of interdependence, which were the great social programs of our time, every single one of which has been either killed or is under assault under this new marvelous neoliberal market-based miracle that we're all supposed to buy into, except it doesn't work for any but the elite of our country, of our provinces, and of our world. So my dad, if he were standing here to you tonight, would say, and I know he'd say this because he said it to me just before he died, this is your generation's version of the war that I fought. This is about human dignity. This is about fundamental rights that were fought by other generations. People have lived and died to give us these rights, and it is not going to be handed away to a bunch of people in suits eating dinners that are more than most people's weekly pay, so that they can see the fruits of a kind of vision that's an exclusionary vision only for themselves. And we have to tell our politicians these people did not elect them, and that they speak to us and for us, and we will not rest, and we will democracy will prevail. We and our vision of what this community can look like, what an Atlantica based on something phenomenally different would look like. This is not a Canada versus US or the Maritimes, Atlantic Canada versus New England. That's not at all what this is about. This is about people joining hands across the border with a different vision for what our communities should and must look like. This is not sustainable. What they have in mind, like what they are doing to the world, is not sustainable. Unlimited growth, upon which this is based, has the same DNA as a cancer cell. It has to turn on its host in order to survive. It's not sustainable. We have to say no to this. And it's a huge challenge, and it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of cooperation. We should have some fun while we're doing it, and we better get this right, because we really, when you say it may take the rest of our lives to do this, what else have we got to do? Thank you very much.
Our next speaker, and I wanted to say, yes, Maude, we are standing for something. We stand for another world is possible. And thank you very much for those wonderful comments. We're now going to hear from Andrew Jackson, who's the National Director, Social and Economic Policy with the Canadian Labour Congress. Andrew is also a research professor in the Institute of Political Economy at Carleton University, a research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and a fellow with the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University. During a leave of absence from the CLC in 2002, he was director of research with the Canadian Council on Social Development. Mr. Jackson's area of interest include the labour market and the quality of jobs, income distribution and poverty, macroeconomic policy, social policy, and the impacts of globalization on workers. He has written numerous articles for popular and academic publications and is the author of Work and Labour in Canada, Critical Issues. Please give a very warm welcome to Andrew Jackson.
Well, thank you, and what a great turnout. I must say my dominant thought at the moment is that we should have insisted Maude went last rather than first, say a delight to share a platform with her, but Maude's very much a tough act to follow. I was just sitting thinking, Maude, I remember way back in the first free trade agreement when Maude and Bob White were debating Tom DeQuino on the first free trade agreement. And I think really this alliance between the labor movement, the Council of Canadians, the popular movements around these kinds of struggles is absolutely essential that we continue to sort of act together to block this project. And I think back, you know, that this whole sort of project now of the right, of the corporate elite, that, I mean, these people are absolutely relentless in pushing their vision of this country. No matter the counter struggles against, they're just absolutely relentless in pushing against it. And I must say, Maud is kind of an inspiration in that she's sort of equally relentless in continuing to fight back. And I certainly have moments of discouragement, but this is just a wonderful turnout tonight and really energizing. I think, as Maud said, Atlantica really is a regional dimension of the wider deep integration or NAFTA plus agenda being pushed by our corporate and by our political elites in tandem. And I think this agenda has very serious implications for working people in this region, and that it's a big move in the wrong direction. So I want to just very briefly reprise a bit of the history of cross-border integration as it's been taking place since the original Free Trade Agreement back in 1989, and some of the implications of that, where it's been taking us, and where this new round is taking us, and some grounds for concern and why we should be articulating a different vision. So if we go back to the late 80s, at one level, this process was about tariff reductions, it was about easier cross-border trade, and it was certainly about much easier cross-border flows of investment. And since that period, we indeed have seen quite a dramatic increase in the level of integration between the Canadian and U.S. economies. We saw a huge wave of industrial restructuring in Canada in the late 80s and early 90s, a big round of initial job losses. And we should recall that what this process was really about, what it was sold to us on the basis of, was that it was going to create a basis for growth and for shared prosperity. That's always the line. This is good for the economy. The gains of the economy will be shared. This agenda is good for all of us. But I think we always have to bear in mind that these kinds of trade and investment agreements and more open borders as defined by them results in a major sort of shift in the power relationship in our society from working people towards mobile transnational capital. It's companies that can threaten now much more effectively to move production, jobs, and new investment. And that power has been, I would argue, exercised. So let me just throw one sort of very striking set of numbers out to you, I think. If we take the whole period, and I won't throw out a lot of numbers, but I think this is important. If we take the whole period of the 1990s, so from 1989 to through to 2001, over that whole period, the top 1% of Canadian society of wage and salary earners, and today's terms, the top 1% starts at an income of $170,000. So these are the guys, and they are mainly guys, sitting there with their $600 dinner plates tonight. So that top 1%, in 1989, $9 out of every $100 of Canada's national income, of the total in wages and salaries, went to that top 1%. Over the course of the 1990s through to 2001, that increased to 14%. So a big increase, their share of our total income. And they actually saw an increase in their real income of 65% over the course of the 1990s. If we take that whole same period, the wages of somebody, a worker in the exact middle of the workforce, didn't increase at all after inflation. So 65% increase in real income at the very top, no increase at all for the entire bottom half of the workforce. For an average worker, maybe an increase of 7 or 8%. So there's been an incredibly unequal distribution of the fruits of economic growth over that period. And this was, for the most part, a period in which we did see economic growth. But when we raise the question, who is this agenda working for? How will those gains be distributed? That's almost dismissed by them as an irrelevant question, because the assumption is automatic that growth is shared by everybody. But the reality is, under this agenda, those gains have not been shared. And in many ways, we've seen a real regression of living standards. So it's not just the fact that wages have been flat. The most important income security program for workers, unemployment insurance, was deeply cut back. There's been major changes in the quality of jobs, a shift to much more insecure forms of work, contract work, temporary work. There's no doubt at all that the ability of unions to bargain decent wages and working conditions, health and safety in workplaces, has been rolled back. Since the late 1980s, which was about the peak of unionization in Canada, we have seen private sector unionization, particularly in the sectors of the economy most exposed to international trade, erode. So we still have strong unions in the private sector, but we are down to a 20% unionization rate. Still a lot bigger than 8% in the private sector in the US. Still a really significant, important difference, but a shrinking difference. And I'd argue that's very closely linked to the fact that in a completely integrated economic space, subject only to market principles, that business will relentlessly seek high productivity, highest quality work at the lowest possible cost, and they will use that pressure to erode wages and working conditions. And the other dimension of that, I think in an integrated economic space, there's always relentless pressure as well from the business community for lower taxes on them and for lower taxes on high-income earners. And it's, if you recall the great free trade debate, I think Tom DeQuino in that debate sort of absolutely denied that there was any link at all between Canada as a social project, as being about equality, fairness, decent social programs, that there was no link at all to that. This was a purely economic arrangement. And then as soon as that set of agreements was in place, then the whole argument shifted to we had to become competitive in this new integrated economic environment, and low taxes for business, for the high-income earners, was a very key part of that competitive equation. And I don't think free trade has been the only factor at play or economic integration. There's other aspects to the broader neoliberal agenda. But I think it was because of closer integration that business did demand major cuts to the unemployment insurance program to create a greater sense of insecurity amongst workers. And certainly that drive for lower taxes combined with the deficit and debt was a major reason for the cutbacks we had in the social programs in this country over the 1990s. And, you know, one thing I think is just incredibly tragic is just 2 and 3 years ago, we were just beginning to see the beginnings of a reinvestment in our social programs in the minority parliament, the last period of the Chrétien government, the last minority parliament. And I think now we've seen, again, a major shift back after just a beginnings of a shift in a more progressive direction. I think at a second level, and even more importantly, what integration is really about as well is about reducing the policy space for governments to shape economic and regional development in the interests of working families. And as Maud has said, this also implies a shrinking scope for democracy. And I think, as I said, I think in economic integration is just one part of the wider right-wing agenda, but I think it's a very important part because it embeds or constitutionalizes or sets in binding rules limits on what governments can do. So it's not just the fact that we have right-wing governments periodically, but that we have a set of rules confronting different kinds of governments as they're elected. So what are these most critically? I think it's about a reduced ability of governments to tie investment, and particularly foreign investment, to jobs, job creation, to retention of jobs, to investment here in Canada. It's certainly about a reduced ability of governments to limit resource-based exports and to require the processing of our resources, developments of spin-offs from our resource industries here in Canada. And I think what's problematic about this agenda is not so much trade with the United States and the rest of the world, which I think is on balance a good thing. I don't believe in a nationally self-sufficient Canada. But I think what's critically important is if we lose the tools that governments, that communities have to shape economic development in the interests of workers and communities. And I think there are strategies available to us where we can use trade and economic linkages as a lever for development. But that's not what we get with these kinds of agreements which tie the hands of governments. So what did NAFTA really accomplish in terms of economic development? Well, there's no doubt that after the initial restructuring of the economy, we did actually see a big increase in Canadian exports to the United States over the 1990s. And that continued until very recently, which was mainly because we had quite a low dollar in relation to the American dollar. So let's not deny that there has been a big increase in trade. But what's also true and what flies in the face of what was promised is over this whole period, our economy has actually not diversified, not become a higher value-added, more sophisticated, more knowledge-intensive economy, creating more skilled and better jobs, but has become actually a much more heavily resource-based economy, driven directly by the resource needs of the world and of the United States. So just to throw one number out at you again, making it more than one number, I suppose, 60% of our exports now are consists of resources. Now, it's a slightly complicated calculation because it looks bigger for the manufactured sector, but then you've got to strip out what we import in order to re-export. So in the auto industry, for example, we bring in a lot of components, assemble them, send them out. But if you look at the value added of all of our exports, 60% is now resources. And that has been increasing very rapidly. It's been driven by oil and gas in particular, but by a range of minerals. And my sense of glancing over the numbers for Atlantic Canada is that's been very true for this region as well, that the increase in trade that we've seen south to the U.S. under NAFTA has been still mainly in the resource sector. Now, that's not to say there aren't other important parts of our economy that have grown to some degree, our machinery and equipment industries. But we have, through this model, I think, really locked in a much more traditional economic pattern of Canada as essentially a producer of resources for the U.S. economy. And we do get some good jobs out of the resource sector, no doubt about it. But we don't get anywhere near the kind of jobs that one would get from an equivalent amount of capital invested in other sectors. You take jobs in a refinery in the oil sands, these are enormously capital-intensive operations. Yeah, and one of the great ironies really about NAFTA as an economic agenda, I mean, at one level, if you listen to the business elites, they celebrate our economic gains, everything's wonderful, trade has increased, and then they go off and huddle in conferences all about by themselves, and they fret about the fact that the productivity gap with the U.S. has continued to widen. If you read them carefully, the chartered banks are putting out reports, and they're fretting about the fact that the profits of Canadian business as a share of our economy now are at an all-time historic high, but they're investing very little outside the resource sector. So there's huge investments in the oil sands in Alberta, but I mean, those profits overall are going into just very small parts of our economy. Huge amounts are being rebated back to shareholders. Of course, their answer to that is cut business taxes even further, even though we're already below the U.S. But there really is this kind of level at which, if the agenda isn't working, the only answer is not to question the agenda, but to relentlessly drive it one stage further. So it's kind of, if you're in a hole, as the adage is, well, we've got to kind of keep digging, and sooner or later we'll get out of this. And what's also really striking is this agenda hasn't delivered what it was supposed to do, which was guaranteed access to the American market. That was the one thing that free trade was supposed to do. And, of course, the key case here is softwood lumber, where we've had two final panel decisions on the extraordinary panel, which we were told would never be invoked, and it was only to sort of deal with Canadian paranoia about the U.S. administrative structure. They set aside two definitive panel rulings. They're going to keep a portion of those tariffs that they put on softwood lumber. They're not going to remit them back. Harper's capitulating and describing this as part of the new friendly agenda. And I mean, in a sense, it's really the U.S. has unilaterally abrogated NAFTA. They have refused to live up to the agreement. And of course, it's not just lumber. In the case of Atlantic Canada, it's been agricultural exports, others. So, I mean, agreement or no agreement, it continues to be the case that the U.S. is the stronger partner in this relationship, and when they choose to throw their weight around, that they do. And then on top of that, of course, what's happened post 9/11, we've had a context in the U.S. where security agendas trump the trade agenda. So there has been this incredible paranoia amongst the business elite about how the hell do we get goods and services across this border, which, despite all these agreements, remains a huge reality, that border that stretches across Canada. So their reaction is, of course, as Maud said, not to question NAFTA, to seek to disentangle to some degree, to regain some policy space, but rather to dig in even deeper. I mean, we have incredibly supine corporate elite. They have just a total fixation on deepening continental integration. So we've had the Security and Prosperity Partnership launched by the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Its main aspects, again, Maud flagged, just military and security harmonization with the U.S., major sort of ramping up of the security role of the federal government in response. Regulatory harmonization, this process of bureaucrats and business executives sitting together behind closed doors to regulate, to harmonize our regulation. But also what I place a bit of emphasis on in the Atlantica context is this notion of actually deepening NAFTA to go to to cement a resource pact. So they're talking about much closer integration in the oil and gas sector in particular. So they really want an absolute assurance that if we build the Mackenzie Valley pipeline to bring gas down to the oil sands, development of the tar sands, that will require huge amounts of capital from the U.S. They see that as absolutely integral to the energy security of the United States. So this is a huge part of this agenda now is absolutely locking our oil and gas sectors into. But it's bigger than that. They're talking about a completely integrated North America-wide electricity grid. And water is definitely back on the table as well. They're also putting back on the table a few of the areas which were actually excluded from NAFTA, the most important being the limits on U.S. takeovers in our cultural sector. And they're talking about a common trade policy between us and the U.S., which is profoundly important because to this point, just to give one example outside the cultural area, the Canadian government has, under a lot of pressure, continued to say that we should limit the purchase of these trade and investment agreements around public and social services to limit their impact as drivers of privatization. If you go to the Romano report, identified by Romano is incredibly important in terms of preserving space for a public health system. If you talk about a common trade policy with the U.S., I mean, do we really expect the U.S. trade negotiator to go to the WTO and sort of fight for our Medicare system? I don't think so. So where does Atlantica fit into all this? Well, first of all, I mean, as clear, I mean, it's, again, all about open borders. And the illusion is that we can make this border disappear just by following the U.S. agenda. I guess you have to ask the question, where are the U.S. elites in the U.S. part of Atlantica that are going to bat for open Canadian access to their market? I don't see rallies in Boston against the softwood lumber deal. I mean, is the U.S. fishing industry sort of demanding easier access for the Canadian fishery products? I mean, it's just like the Security and Prosperity Partnership nationally. You got all of the Canadian elites assembled, and then who did they manage to sort of grab from the U.S.? Like a Michigan governor from three terms ago is about the best they can sort of really assemble. So, I mean, the notion that the U.S. corporate elite is itself committed to a fundamentally different relationship with Canada is incredibly problematic. I think the resources issue, I think, is a really important one for this region. I think it is very much on the table in the regional context. They haven't talked about this very much. They are talking about shared electricity grids. But there are, I think, some really key questions to be asked for Atlantic Canadians. I mean, when we look at the offshore oil and gas accords, we negotiated, or the provinces as controllers of those resources, did negotiate the ability to have industrial offsets within the region. So as oil and gas development went ahead, a lot of the procurement requirements were to be filled within Canada. What's the Atlantica vision on that? Do they believe in having value added in Canada spinning off from oil and gas developments as further developments go forward? You take Voisey's Bay in Newfoundland. The provincial government there basically negotiated a smelter as the price of developing that resource. What do the people who are proposing Atlantica say about that, that we should require minerals, the jobs flowing from those minerals, to be based in Atlantic Canada rather than raw materials shipped out? What about the fishery? I haven't heard anybody say anything about the fishery. If we go back to the free trade agreement, that was actually rather a closely fought thing. There were claims coming from the U.S. They wanted free access to the Canadian fishery. We can't just reserve those Canadian fish for Canadian fishermen. I mean, that's protectionist. I haven't heard a word said about that. So I think the key principle that should really be put forward is that Atlantic Canadians should have control over their own resources to develop in the interests of the people in the region. And there's really very little point in having provincial control of oil and gas resources and mineral resources, for example, if we give the real control to transnational corporations. I mean, that provincial control comes with a purpose, I think, to develop those resources in the interests of the people in the region. I think, as has been said, this Atlantica initiative, the way they're putting it forward, is very squarely about further entrenching an anti-labor, corporate-driven model of economic development. So they're explicitly talking about weaker unions, even lower minimum wages, even lower taxes, lower social spending. So they're really talking about gaining competitiveness in an integrated market in a very particular way. And again, to come back to what I was saying, I think, again, the problem isn't trade per se, it's on what basis we trade. And I think the model of an economy we should be seeking is where employers and governments are investing very heavily in innovation and skills and research and development to really ramp up the knowledge basis of our economy to be producing much more sophisticated goods and services. And that requires good, decent labor standards, investment in people, not this race to the bottom that the Atlantica people are talking about. So my time's running out. I guess I did just want to flag one other really big point, which is that we're in a context now where the center of gravity in this global economy which we inhabit is very much decisively shifting away from Europe and North America towards developing Asia in particular. One striking fact, you know, the growth of the Chinese labor force over the last 10 years, the growth in the Chinese labor force is bigger than the North American and European labor force combined. Growth in the U.S., and that growth has been important for us in Canada, has been fueled by an incredible sort of run-up of household debt, of government debt. They run a huge balance of payments deficit. And the reality is the U.S. is going to be forced to rebalance that. So we're going to have a period ahead of us of much slower U.S. economic growth. I would suspect a much more protectionist U.S. in many ways to deal with that issue. And that really, I think, tells us that rather than further deepening this relationship, we need economic strategies that situate us in a much broader environment. So I had some other things to say, but I'll shut up and sit down and leave it to questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and you will get another opportunity. We're delighted to have as our third speaker our American friend, Matt Schlabaum, who's the coordinator of the Maine Trade Free Trade Campaign. The Maine Free Trade Campaign is a statewide coalition of 40 organizations working to promote fair trade policies in a more just, sustainable, and democratic local and global economy. Since graduating from Bates College in 2000, Matthew has worked with several organizations in Maine on issues of economic justice, undoing racism, and forest protection. He has served as coordinator of the Fair Trade Coalition since 2003. He lives in Green, Maine. Please welcome Matt.
It's great to be here. And it's great to see such an inspiring large crowd. We don't have crowds like this in Maine. It's good to see these faces. So I do work for the Maine Fair Trade Campaign. We're a statewide coalition. And I want to talk a little bit about why I'm here. I think a lot of, you know, I talked to a few folks in the media beforehand, and they said, why are you here from the U.S.? What does the U.S. have to gain from opposing Atlantica or being engaged in all this? And, you know, I think it's pretty clear in my mind. It's because this model, this NAFTA model, has been devastating to the majority of people in the U.S. I think there's a common, you know, we sort of lose sight of the fact that, you know, that the majority of people are losers under this model, right? It's elites in the U.S. and elites in Canada and elites in Mexico who have won under NAFTA and who have won under this neoliberal economy that they're building. But the majority of people have lost. And yes, you know, the U.S. is filled with hypocrisies when it comes to trade and the softwood lumber dispute. But it's crucial that we not mix up the American population, the American people, from the elites, the owning class, the ruling class in the U.S. that really has benefited under this model. Thanks. And I'm here because we have to build, if we're going to win in a global economy, if we're going to create a global economy that actually values working families and creates real security for people, we have to organize across borders. We have to be building relationships and solidarity and cooperation across regions, across borders, and putting forward a different vision than the one we've been living under for the last 30 years or so in the U.S. And I'm here because, you know, Ben Franklin said the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. Right? Atlantica is just it's a rewarmed leftover version of NAFTA that wants to be intensified, you know, and we've been screwed on that, we've lost out on that. And so to simply, you know, put forward that model in a deeper form and expect different results is insanity. And that's not the path to go down, and we need to push against that. And I'm here because I fundamentally believe that if we work together, build cross-border alliances, we can defeat this, and we have to defeat this. We have to turn around this agenda and put forward an agenda that has our values at its core. You know, and I think, you know, all that said, you know, it's pretty clear when people relate to people, when folks sit down, that Maine, that Vermont, that New Hampshire, that this region of the northern U.S. and this region of Canada have a lot in common. I think there's a shared work ethic, there's shared values, there's a shared cultural history. And in a lot of ways, increased cooperation, increased people-to-people relations, increased economic relationships based on economic justice and real values would be a positive agenda. It's something that we should be talking about. What is our vision of that kind of cross-border cooperation look like? That's a path we should be going down. But as always, the devil is in the details. It's what are the rules? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to lose as a result? And when you look closely at Atlantica, or when you look closely at this deeper agenda, this larger agenda of deep integration, it's very clear that those are not values that the majority of people in Canada and the U.S. hold. It's very clear that that model of integration is a model that's going to fail the majority of people. And I think, you know, this whole question of Atlantica, when you look at the proposal and the emerging proposals very closely at all, it's clear that they're based on neoliberal corporate values, neoliberal corporate ideas, and about expanding a model that, you know, that really thrived on those ideas in NAFTA. And it's also clear that, you know, that it's part of this larger deep integration project. And the very language clearly implies, for Canadians, moving towards a U.S. economic and social model. And from someone who's been living in that model and working with people trying to push back on that model, I can say to you very clearly and emphatically that is not the model that you want to be moving towards. That's not the model that you want to be integrating with. So So, you know, let's just paint a quick picture of what you'd be integrating into, and deeply integrating for that matter. You know, the U.S. right now is 55 million people that have no health insurance, zero, zip. The emergency room is their health insurance in the wealthiest country in the world. You know, it's a moral tragedy. And another 55, 60 million who are grossly underinsured, right? Wages in the United States are at 1973 levels in terms of their real purchasing power. Right, there's this incredible stagnation of wages while corporate profits hit all-time highs. Poverty has increased for the last 4 years and is at record levels. Our country, as earlier speakers have talked about, is deeply, deeply indebted. Our trade deficit is hitting record levels, and there is a day of reckoning that's going to come. The reason the pain of stagnating wages hasn't been more serious is because we're living on cheap credit and foreign debt that's going to catch up with us and going to be a painful point of reckoning. You know, in a lot of ways, the U.S. right now is in a situation that the Soviet Union was in before it collapsed, right? Our military spending is through the roof. We're spending more than half of every dollar taxpayers pay goes to the largest military machine in the world. Meanwhile, our infrastructure is crumbling. We're not investing in people. We're not investing in bridges. We're not investing in roads. We're not investing in schools. We're not investing in the things that are fundamentally important. And we've seen that recipe of empire time and time again. When you put your money into military might, overextend yourselves, and don't invest in the basic fundamentals of a society, your society collapses, you know, in a variety of forms. And so that's the path we're on. Again, not one you want to deeply integrate with. You know, the list goes on. You know, we're Social Security, a fundamental, the most successful anti-poverty program in U.S. history. You know, it was on the chopping block. Was privatization of it was pushed back, thankfully, thanks to unions and allies and all the folks like you in this room who fought against that in the U.S. But that's the worldview that the folks who are pushing this model have, and that's what they're going after. Ecologically, you know, we're going down the exact opposite road of where we need to be going. You know, an ecological disaster that we're, you know, just ignoring and just blatantly, arrogantly disregarding its impact, its long-term impact, its impact on the rest of the world. And as everyone knows, you know, we have one of the most regressive, deceitful, arrogant administrations in history. And a larger worldview, that's what we talk about as a yo-yo worldview that's pushing this, right? You're on your own. Margaret Thatcher said, you know, in her vision of neoliberalism, there's no such thing as society. That's the direction these folks want to move the United States in and have been, you know, very successfully over the last 30 years. Again, not what you want to move towards. In that race to the bottom that's part of the global economy, we're winning the race. I don't think you want to join us, right? So, you know, it's a basic point. It's not the path you want to follow. It's not the path that the rest of the hemisphere is following. There's a strong, vibrant rejection of neoliberalism, of the Washington consensus, of the U.S. model of how to organize economies and nation states. And we need to be moving in a different direction from that. We need to be putting forward a different vision. And we're in fundamentally a different place in the U.S., right, than you are here. Here, I think you're fighting to preserve the social rights that have been won and trying to keep them as rights. In the U.S., we're trying to fight to turn things that have been commodified and turn commodities into a right. It's a hell of a lot harder to move something from a commodity back to a right, like healthcare. So don't lose that. Don't let it be taken away by deep integration, by NAFTA, by this agenda. You know, the U.S. has spent years trying to impose this model on the rest of the world, and done so, you know, with some success, some very bloody, violent, brutal success. But the world is also saying no. So that, you know, don't willfully step into that model. That's foolish and back to Ben Franklin's insanity. So just to step back for a quick second here. You know, I think when we look more closely at Atlantica, it's very clear that it's, you know, it's based on a NAFTA plus, a NAFTA on steroids, if you will. you know, taking those, that set of rules, intensifying it, deepening it, expanding it. Most of the work that the coalition that I'm part of does in Maine is on trade issues, and it's about trying to turn around this agenda and turn around this U.S. trade policy. And I think, you know, I think it's important that we reframe the debate around trade, because I don't fundamentally think it's a debate about trade, right? As earlier speaker said, you know, trade has plenty of benefits when done well. But fundamentally, the agreements that U.S. capital pushed were about creating conditions, creating a set of rules, creating that slide where they can move production anywhere in the world to find the cheapest places of production, the places with the least environmental standards. Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, said very blatantly and frankly, you know, ideally we'd have every one of our plants on a barge so we could move it to wherever we could find the cheapest cost of production. Right? Again, that's their yo-yo, you're on your own worldview. That's not our worldview. But it's also these trade deals have also been about creating a set of rules, a set of conditions, creating a global economy where corporations can slip out of a social contract, can slip out of the restraints and the victories that people fought and died for over a century of struggle. The trade policy that the U.S. government has been pushing is about rolling back the 20th century in our country, right? Because people fought and died for a weekend. People fought and died for an eight-hour day. People fought and died for basic protections on the job, for basic protections for the environment. And all of that is being rolled back. It's obviously not being rolled back solely by trade policy. Our trade rules are one piece of it that allows corporations, you know, to get out of a social contract, to move where they can, you know, lower standards and move away from that and move away from those things that we fought for. And, it, you know, as earlier folks have talked about sort of this history of struggle that we inherit, this, you know, this ability to keep a struggle moving, we have to remember what kind of sacrifice people paid and what kind of responsibility that puts on our shoulders to move, you know, to not let those gains be lost. The second point in reframing the trade debate or the Atlantica debate is fundamentally to remember that it's a debate about rules. It's about what kind of rules are going to structure regional economies, what kind of rules are going to structure the global economy, who gets to make the decisions about them, and who wins and loses as a result. The globalizers, the corporate free traders, are very explicit. Renato Ruggiero, the former director of the World Trade Organization, said very bluntly, we're writing a single constitution for the global economy, right? These are enforceable rules. They have their own private courts for capital to enforce those rules. And although the U.S. often doesn't follow them, we do damn well insist that the rest of the world does and that they have some real teeth to them. And if we look at our own history in the United States, we saw a constitution, a domestic constitution, that was written by the property class for the property class, and that constitution excluded everyone else. You know, it had no rights for people of color, no rights for women, no rights for very few rights for non-property owning males initially, right? And through a century plus of struggle, rights were put into that constitution. And the fact that the Constitution didn't have rights for other parties, for other actors, for other values, almost led to the disintegration of our country, right? A civil war was fought in the United States because they created a Constitution that didn't have rights or values for the majority as a core part of it. So when people ask me, you know, why were there 60,000 people out in the streets at the World Trade Organization? Why were there 70,000 people out in the streets at the G8? My answer is, you know, they're writing a Constitution for the global economy that doesn't have any of us at the table or doesn't have any of our interests at the core. That's a pretty serious problem. And so, you know, all constitutions have philosophical underpinnings. They have, you know, they have political, philosophical ideas that are at their basis. And when we look at, you know, the NAFTA model, the CAFTA model, the WTO model, it's a neoliberal constitution. It's a constitution built on the idea that there is no such thing as society, that the decisional body for all of us should be the unregulated free market, that a democratic state where we all participate and have a voice is a relic of the past and should have its hands tied behind its back, that the only actors who are fit to make decisions and structure society are multinational corporations, and the only people who should be given rights are investors, right? That's not our vision for the world, and that's not the set of rules that we want. When you look at Atlantica, it's a regional replication of that model. It's trying to draft a set of rules, a set of policies that, you know, sound innocuous on the surface. Who could be opposed to trade between Atlantic Canada and Northern New England? That sounds great. You know, we'll throw in a little increased transportation. That sounds great too. You know, we can do a little energy exchange. Nice idea. But, you know, let's scratch below the surface. If you look at the values, the ideas that are pushed behind this proposal, right? Let's go to the Ames website. As far as I can tell here, the think tank that's most aggressively pushing this. You know, they say very clearly that this region suffers from poor quality public policy that holds Atlantica back and it needs to be reformed. What are those things? Minimum wage legislation is a poor quality public policy. Union density, right? Unions, the most effective anti-poverty program the world has seen, right? Those are a form of poor... That's poor quality public policy that needs to be reversed, undermined, scrapped through this deep integration regional model of NAFTA plus. You know, the size of a government that works in the interest of people, size of government relative to the economy, that's a poor quality public policy. So we start to get the picture of what, you know, what they're after, what kind of values, what kind of ideas, what kind of rules are going to underlie this model of integration. There's also... There's also a lot of rhetoric about removing non-tariff barriers to trade. Again, it sounds nice. You know, what the hell is a non-tariff barrier to the trade? What the hell would it have to do with my life? But what it's really about is it's about all the things that we democratically work to put in place to raise up standards, to create meaningful environmental standards, to create meaningful public health standards, to create meaningful standards to promote food safety, meaningful protections on the job. All of those things they're not tariffs, but they're barriers to trade. So, you know, let's figure out a new way to axe that agenda, right? So that's what this is about. And it's really important that we also recognize that neoliberalism, you know, it fights on a lot of levels. It puts its agenda forward in a lot of levels, but it fights aggressively on the level of ideas, on the playing field of ideas, right? NAFTA was proposed in 1979 as a concept by Ronald Reagan, and it kicked around in think tanks and was honed and refined and given lots of these $600 dinners and ultimately became the law of the land. And so we have to take that contesting on the level of ideas very seriously and be putting out, you know, strong critiques of this and strong visions of what we want. A bit on the good news, just to talk about what some of your brothers and sisters to the South have been doing to try and push back on this agenda, because in the U.S., the only place where you can push progressive legislation and progressive reform right now is at the state level. We've been doing a lot of work to try and, you know, to try and rework, to try and scrap this NAFTA model and put forward a new model in its place. We recently got our governor to take Maine out of the GATS agreement, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. Right, which is a tremendous victory because, you know, trade rules simply shouldn't be regulating what we can and cannot do with healthcare. Maine pulled itself out of our healthcare commitments in the GATS. They shouldn't be regulating land use and zoning decisions at the local and state level. They shouldn't be telling us what we can or cannot do in terms of funding public libraries, what we can and cannot do in terms of funding public education. That's not what a trade agreement is about, right? But for corporations, it is, because that's a tool and a means and a vehicle to put forward rules that states, local communities, and countries have to conform with. We created a Citizens Trade Policy Commission at the state level in Maine to give citizens a real voice in these issues, to look at all of the democracy issues, NAFTA's investment chapter, what it means for public policy, and a commission that holds public hearings throughout the states and amplifies the voice of citizens. Our governor, through a lot of good work of people in Maine, recently formed a governor's coalition on sweat-free purchasing and workers' rights to ensure that our taxpayer dollars, when we spend them, go towards making sure that people have basic decency and good working conditions and aren't supporting sweatshops. So, you know, I think that's a vision of the kind of... That's a vision of the kind of state work, regional model that we want to be moving toward. That's not a vision that Atlantica puts forward or espouses. I think the challenge for us, clearly, as we go ahead, is to figure out how to build, you know, deeper cross-border alliances. One of the challenges, right? The investor class is clearly very well organized on a global level, and they're writing global, regional, sub-regional